And good to see him attack. Missed it.
And flushed by Larry Nance Jr.
Nance measures.
And he hits a 16-footer.
Nance open again.
Hit it again.
Nance a bump.
And a bucket and a foul. Nance with a steal.
Boy, oh boy.
He's omnipresent.
He is something else.
Inside Larry and a finish for J.R. Smith. How many Larry Nance Jr.'s are there out there?
Putting Larry Nance Jr.
Who drills it? He's hit three jumpers tonight.
So Larry with a career high with 20 points.
We made them feel our presence. You know, we hit first and had an aggressive mentality from the start. Just establishing myself on the inside first. Once they did that, they had to respect the outside. They had to sag off something. Those guys gave me great looks at the top, and I got to knock those down as well.
We did it by committee. It started with me and Larry, obviously. You know, we knew he was going to have to try to do a job on those two big guys that they had with Blake and Drace. High energy plays is what he's all about. Very fast, athletic, puts himself in a position to be successful on the floor. He's always in the right spots.
We're just right now really aren't giving ourselves much of a chance to play well because we're playing so frustrated right now. Frustrated with the referees, frustrated even more by the ball not going in the basket. We're a very frustrated group right now. It's very hard to play like that. What we're getting right now is we're getting one or two guys play well on any given night. We're just not getting enough people to play well, particularly offensively shooting the ball. We can never find more than one or two guys that are making shots.
The G League wants to up the ante and say, okay, there are right. guys that will go straight to the NBA. You other guys, if you can't make it to the NBA, don't want to go to college, come here. You're going to get paid more than the $26,000. We're going to prepare you for the professional life of an NBA. We're just going to do it better for you. So if you don't want to go to college, you don't have to go to college.
For some of these kids to just go play overseas, or like the Ball Brothers are doing right now, instead of going to college. Me personally, I was excited about going to Duke and having a chance to win a championship and winning a championship and enjoying that whole college atmosphere. I was there for 3 years. I really enjoyed my college personally. For me, it was perfect for me, but like I said, it's situational for each individual kid.
There's a difference between being elite and elitist. And the NCAA right now, we have become elitist. We are telling a bunch of young, largely African-American kids, we don't want you at all if you don't want to buy into our 4 years thing.
Basically, one and done is going to go away, but it's not going to go back to the way that it was back in the early 2000s when a kid could just declare he was going pro and he got drafted by the NBA. The NBA has basically decided that they want to get involved with high school players, and I don't think that they have wanted to do this, and I think they recognize that there's going to be challenges that they can't foresee and there may be stumbles, but they want to be able to get involved and have their hands on high school players and then give them an alternative option when they get out of high school.
I don't give a damn how great he is. You don't take a running back with the number one overall pick in the draft as far as I'm concerned. If I got the number one overall pick, I need somebody that's generational. I need somebody that I think is going to last 10 years. If it ain't a quarterback, it's a Lawrence Taylor type. That's how I'm looking at it. I'm not taking him with the number one overall pick unless I have a quarterback. And last time I checked, the Browns do not.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
My, oh my, those Pistons sure are rallying the troops for Coach Stan Van Sloppy, aren't they? Welcome to this Tuesday edition of the Extravaganza. Excuse me, I'm laughing myself into a cough. As I watch the Pistons just stumble and bumble and fumble their way to getting Stan Van Sloppy fired, and I absolutely love every freaking second of it. My goodness. You know, two things happened yesterday, Jim. The team that I root for, the Cavaliers, got a win, one that they doggone well better have gotten against the pathetic Pistons. That was a good thing. Larry Nance Jr. played his tail off, looking like Pops with 22 and 15 and a couple more monster dunks, taking no prisoners. LeBron James had a brilliant game with 31, 7, and 7. They defended a team that isn't a three-point shooting threat the way that some of the teams that have lit them up are. So I got a good result there from the Cavaliers winning. And I also got a good result there that if the Pistons aren't going to win, let's do it in embarrassing fashion. Let's lose horribly by 22 in order to grease the skids for Stan Van Sloppy getting pushed out of town. Kush, I do me a favor. Give me a little traveling music here while I take a minute or two to do some math. It's going to take that long, I think, for me to count the Pistons' losses in recent days and weeks. One, two, I wish I was on Sesame Street now. We could do a counting lesson. One, two, three. That's three in a row. Then a win over the Bucks. One, two, three. That's three more losses in a row before a win over the Hawks. Or, excuse me, actually after a win over the Hawks. Then one, two, three. That's three more losses in a row before, holy cow. Or actually after, because I'm going in reverse chronological order here. One, two, three, four, five-game winning streak. Well, that obviously must be the real Pistons, except that before that, it's one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, and on down the line we go. The Pistons are trash, and it's not because the Pistons players are all trash. And it's not certainly because they don't have a first-rate facility in which to play. The facility at Little Caesars is not trash. It's not because they have a fan base that doesn't support them, because the fans are not trash. The Pistons are trash because they're being coached trashily. Yes, I just created an adverb. Trashily coached by Stan Van Sloppy. Stan is on his way out as club president. President of Basketball Operations. Stan is on his way out as head coach, and Stan ought to not let the door hit him on his way out. He is now 29-35 on a season that they were supposed to take a giant step forward. Stan Van Sloppy has, Cushion, help me remember the win totals now for Slop in his 4 years now on the job when he signed a 5-year help my memory here. Is $35 million contract?
About that.
Yeah, $7 million a year. Pretty doggone healthy contract to be both president of basketball ops and also the head coach. I do believe in his first year, he won 29 games, I want to say.
32.
Pretty close. I was within three.
You're close.
That elevated in year number two to 44, right?
Yep, and the first round exit.
That's a 12-game improvement, though. Clearly, Stan is doing some things the right way. Yes, first-round exit at the hands of the Cavaliers.
That's what I thought. That's what I certainly thought all that summer. We all remember my predictions for the next year.
Yes, I do, because going into year three of the slot period, yes, indeed, you said they should not only get back into the playoffs again, but not in the eighth seed where they have to get rolled by the Cavaliers in round one. They'll probably be up pushing possibly for a home court advantage in the first round. They should be in the top four of the eight teams in the Eastern Conference playoffs. And instead, Jim, and I'm doing this totally by memory. I have nothing in front of me. That's why I guessed 29 before. So it was 32 to 44. Then I want to say it fell back to about 37.
That's exactly right. 37. Fell back to 37. Yep.
Yeah.
Good call.
Yeah, 37 in year three. That pushing up to the fourth spot didn't exactly work out. They failed to make the playoffs altogether. And now this season, it's time to push it back up again, get the ship on the right, the ships don't go on tracks. I'm mixing my transportation metaphors. Ships are on the open sea. It's trains on the tracks. Getting the train back on track, Conductor Slop is going to turn this thing around. And here we sit on March 6th at... let me just do the math here real quick. 55 and 9, 64. 64 games in. That means, by my count, 18 remaining.
Yep.
And the Slopsters are 29 and 35, pacing the way they're playing now to finish worse than that 37-win fiasco.
Actually, I'm looking at the winning percentages right next to the win totals right now. Actually, they're projected to exactly finish 37-45. That's 37-45 is 451. The 29-35 is 453.
I'm gonna project lower though, Jim.
Oh, I am too. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying.
Yeah, based on how they're playing now, because obviously that is taking the whole season into account.
Yes.
And I'm taking this period of time into account. We're talking about, since the trade deadline, for example, even counting the five-game winning streak, we are talking about a simply awful performance. They have lost six out of their last seven. They have lost nine out of their last 11. Nine out of their last 11, I believe. And then if you go back to the seven losses prior to the five-game winning streak, again, just continue to do the math. What's that, 16 out of their last 23?
Yep.
They're awful, and they're not getting better, and they don't play together. They don't have an offensive identity, And you can say, well, I, you know, they're playing without Reggie. Reggie Jackson's a nice point guard. He's important to that team. I will grant you. Reggie Jackson is not Kyrie Irving. Reggie Jackson is not Kyle Lowry. Reggie Jackson is not John Wall. He's not Damian Lillard. He's not Steph Curry. He's not Russell Westbrook. He's not Chris Paul. So when people say, well, you know, it's not really fair, their point guard is missing. Again, no disrespect to Reggie. He's a nice player. He's not one of the top half, excuse me. I told you I knew I was going to laugh myself into a cough over that outcome last night. Apologies. He's not one of the top, I don't know, I might argue he's not one of the top half of point guards in the NBA. Would I be off in that?
No.
Is that unfair? I mean, I just
no. He's a nice player, and certainly the way
like
the
eight or 10 or something off the top. Yeah. There, but I don't know if I had to rank all 30 point guards. But.
No, but you're right on though. I mean, he's not at the level of some of the guys you just named. He's an important piece for this team as it's currently constructed. And yes, it would be very nice for a bunch of reasons if he were there. But he is not one of the upper echelon guys like some of the ones you were named.
So it's not like if the Thunder lost Russell Westbrook, oh my, would they feel that? If the if the Celtics, who already lost their second best player, obviously Gordon Hayward in the season opener, if they were to lose Kyrie, you know, and some of those other teams that I just mentioned, if the Blazers were to lose Damian Lillard. You understand the point.
Yeah.
That's a massive thing. And you know what? You really can't hold a coach accountable. But in this case, it's Reggie Jackson, okay?
Let's put it this way. If Reggie, given the way the Pistons have been playing pre and post Blake Griffin trade, if Reggie Jackson had been here this whole time, the way everything's going, I'd give the Pistons two more wins.
I was
going
to say, I was just about to say the same thing. Maybe the percentage goes to a 39 win season. But it would still be a 39-43 season.
Right. It would not negate the discussion we're basically having right now.
Right on. Exactly right. So I just want to continue to underscore the abject failure of the slopster. Stan Van Sloppy is simply not getting it done. He sold the city. He sold the owner. He sold the players a bill of goods. I just think the guy is not a very good basketball coach. And he's even worse as a basketball executive. And I go back, and I know he had some decent runs with his Orlando teams at the time. And I know he had a decent run with Miami, technically not really, though, because he got canned in the middle of the season by Pat Riley, said, I'll take it from here. And Pat Riley coached that team to a championship. I'm just not sold on Stan Van Gundy's philosophy. I'm not sold on his commitment. I'm not sold on his ability to inspire players, quite frankly. I think he's more interested in other things than winning games and coaching teams. And maybe he wants to run for office or something. But Stan Van Sloppy is guiding his team directly out of the playoff chase. Kush, where are they now? Do you have the standings in front of you?
I do indeed. The Bucks and the Heat are now tied for 7th and 8th. 5 games up on the Pistons. Pistons are 6 under 500, and those two teams I just mentioned are 4 over. So once again, the gap keeps widening. It's not just that the Pistons are losing to make these win-loss projections we were talking about. The gap in front of them with your Bucks and Heat and 76ers and the like keeps growing, and that's the real problem,
really,
as you pointed out, only 18 games to go.
And it's really, though, because they're losing. What I mean by that
sure.
The Bucks aren't exactly like, you know, rolling. They've lost 6 of their last 10. They're 4-6 in their last 10, and yet the lead over the Pistons has grown because the Pistons are 2-8 in theirs. And extending on, like I said, they've lost 9 of their last 11 and 16 out of their last 23. The
key is the Heat have won 4 of their last 5 right as the Pistons are doing this.
Very true. So they've extended their lead over them a little bit because of that. The 76ers have won 7 out of their last 10, so they're winning. But what I find equally as important here, Jim, is the Pistons aren't even the only team chasing the Heat and the Bucks for that last spot. Charlotte has quietly crept up to within 1 game of ye Pistons.
And I wrote them off as out maybe a month and a half ago.
And
still
by the way, they've done
them
that.
Out.
They've done that. While losing their last 3.
Yep. Yep.
The Hornets have lost three in a row, but they are 5 out of their last 10. They're 5-5 in their last 10. So while the Pistons have been foundering and floundering and going 2-8, the Hornets are 5-5 in their last 10, and they've quietly moved up to 28-36,
yep.
18 games out of first in the Eastern Conference, one game behind the Pistons, who are 17 games out of first, and obviously, as you mentioned, 5 games out of the last playoff spot.
What's interesting
so
about...
now they're being compared with the Charlotte bleeping Hornets.
Yeah, that's not good, because to me, for a while now, the line has been between you have no chance and okay, you're technically in the race, has been right below the Pistons and right ahead of the Hornets. And if this gap is closing, which it is, then I have to put the Pistons on the outside of that, which, by the way, side note means seeding is all we're playing for. I can now feel like I can, if the Pistons are out, which I unfortunately have to now fully acknowledge that they are. 5 out with 18 to go in the NBA is bordering on miracle time. I don't think it's going to happen. Therefore, side note, all 8 teams in the Eastern Conference playoffs are set. It's just a matter of where they're going to be.
You may be very, very, you may very well be correct. I'm trying to think. We don't have top of the mind examples of teams that have blown massive leads late in a season in the NBA the way we do in baseball. You know, we've seen circumstances where teams like the Angels, you know, blew a, you know, I don't know, like a 12-game first-place lead with a month to play, and there's no way somebody's making up 12 games in a month.
Oh, I remember that. That's why they were still called the California Angels,
correct.
For
that's
you youngins out there.
There have been a few examples of that can just come to the top of the mind. I don't know that I've seen one like quite like that in the NBA, and this, of course, wouldn't be from first place to not winning the division
right.
The way that was, but it's last place in terms of the last playoff spot to not making the playoffs. And having two teams with a 5-game bulge over them
yep.
means the Pistons would have to win a lot in the last 18, and those teams, or at least one of those teams, would have to lose an awful lot in the last 18. It's not impossible.
No, it's not.
But the way they are playing now, the fact that that national story ran, Jim, what, 3-4 days ago in the New York Times and in Yahoo Sports and in the Sporting News, multiple national sources reporting that Stan Van Gundy's on the verge of losing his presidency of the basketball ops and, if he doesn't make the playoffs, his job. Since that national memo went out, the Pistons players have responded with 3 consecutive losses. And none of them especially competitive. And that, to me, tells me a lot. There isn't a rally in this group, based on what I'm seeing, based on the 6 out of the last 7, 9 out of the last 11 stuff. There isn't a rally in this group that says, we're going to win 6 out of 8. We're going to win 10 out of 14 and really take control of our own destiny here. Because even if they did have that rally in them, and they have 18 games left, somebody else is going to have to lose an equal number of games compared to their wins in order for this to happen. I don't see it happening. I'm very close, Jim, to just backing you up and saying, let's make the call. We are going to just call this case closed. Give me a gavel. Let me pound it like a judge. Case closed. The Pistons will not make the playoffs, and Stan Van Gundy will not be back. I'm very close to making that declaration on March 6th with 18 games to play.
You know, as am I. And, you know, part of the reason why, even though those kind of things have happened, as you mentioned, in baseball, the reason you don't see it at the edge of the playoff picture in the basketball and the NBA is because, by definition, you're talking about mediocre teams. So, you know, 5-game winning streaks and things of that nature, that the kind of things you need if you're the Pistons to close the gap, they don't really happen as often because you're not dealing with top teams in a division, again, like you described in some of those baseball type of
right.
comebacks. And the fact they play every day. I mean, we're spreading these 18 games out over the course of about, let's call it about 6 weeks, about April 15th-ish is when the regular season ends and we switch into playoff mode. And because you're dealing with mediocre teams, you're going to have the usual win 2 or 3 here, lose 2 or 3 here.
Right.
And so it evens itself out, making it very hard to come back from this kind of deficit. So I'm right about there with you in saying that this sadly is over for the Pistons.
The Pistons, at their best this season, think we're a 500 basketball team in terms of performance. They're a 500 team. Obviously, now their record is significantly below 500. I'm talking about when they were at their best.
Yeah.
If they reacquired their best selves and played 500 the rest of the way. Somebody else, one of those other two teams, is going to have to go five games below 500 to give away their playoff spot. Either the Heat or the Pacers? Now I lost my standings for a second here. Hold on a second. Either the Heat or the Bucks.
Bucks. Yeah, they're Bucks. The ones that have fallen Bucks, there.
Yeah, the Pacers are up high. They're in the four spot. Either the Heat or the Bucks are going to have to play five games below 500 in order for that five-game bulge that they have over the Pistons right now to shrink. I don't see the Pistons becoming the best selves and playing 500 the rest of the way over the last 18 games. If they went 9-9, that would mean that either the Heat or the Bucks would have to go, and I'm assuming they all have about the same amount. Let's see, 64 games. Yep. That they would have to play five games worse than that and go, what, 4-14?
Yep.
If my math is correct. Yeah, they would have to go 4-14 in order for those five games to flip.
Yep.
So I don't see it happen.
I can't see it happening either. It's just...
And that means the Pistons are done. They are clearly the most underachieving team in the Eastern Conference. Maybe in all of the NBA. I don't know. We talked about this about a week ago. Who was expected to do much better? You might say the teams that are in the playoff race, like Oklahoma City, for example. You know, Russell Westbrook was receiving two of the great scores in the game in terms of, and Paul George, one of the best two-way players too, and Carmelo Anthony. They probably expected to be a lot better than a 7 seed in the West right now when they added those guys. They're underachieving to a 37-28 seventh seed right now, but underachieving and making the playoffs is a lot better than underachieving and being where the Pistons are. The Nuggets have probably outplayed what they thought they would be in the eighth spot right now. Clippers may be in that boat with the Pistons as underachieving, but of course they traded Blake to the Pistons. After losing Chris Paul, so you know they couldn't have expected to do a whole heck of a lot more than being +6. I think Coach Doc Rivers is actually doing a pretty good job there, all things considered, you know, after Paul and Blake being traded then. Jazz, Lakers, Kings, Mavs, none of them are really just expected to do a whole heck of a lot. So
and the Jazz, for what it's worth, are over 500.
Team in the NBA this year, understand that I'm going to go ahead.
Yeah, and in terms of the disappointing teams, I can't even really count the Jazz as much. You know, as you said, you know, they're on the outside looking in, but they're four games over 500 in that West, and that's after losing Gordon Hayward. They're only a game and a half out of playoff spots. I can't really consider them. You know, so it's hard to figure out who is more disappointing overall in the NBA. Absolutely agreed. No one is more disappointing right now in the Eastern Conference, I think, overall than the Pistons. And for anyone who wants to say the Cavs, well, they're still going to be a top three or four the way it's all shaking out. As you pointed out correctly, still being in the playoffs while being disappointing is a little bit better than being disappointing and not in the playoffs at all.
Absolutely. No question about it. And I'll tell you what, if you look at the Jazz and you weigh that, you know, level of underachievement or disappointment or whatever against the fact that they're in the West, that's a game changer. Can you imagine what the Pistons' record would be if they had to play the West?
Ugh.
If they were sitting in the West.
It'd be a little uglier than that, that's for sure.
Really, really a horrific turn of events for the Pistons. They gave Stan Van Gundy that five-year, $7 million per year contract to become title contenders, to become conference title contenders, and instead it has gone just the opposite. They are no closer to being a contender now in year four of Stan Van Sloppy than they were in year number one. And I, personally, could not be happier. Not for Pistons fans. I love you. Not for the Pistons players. I have no reason to oppose you guys. I mean, I'm a Cavs fan first, but I have nothing against Pistons players. But Stan Van Gundy has earned every bit of his pain, and you know what? It doesn't upset me at all that he's experiencing it. All right, it's 3:31. We got about our local sports center coming up. We also have to get wild. Kush?
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
In the latest moment of Pistons misery last night, the Cavaliers win Nary Lance Jr. Scored a career-high 22 points, which was also his first career 20-point game. Doing it in Cleveland made it all a small bit of history as well, as his father, Larry Sr., had 149 20-plus point games for the Cavaliers in his career. And according to Elias, the Nances for Cleveland are just the fifth father-son duo in NBA history to score 20 points in a game for the same franchise. The other four, if you're wondering, and we know that you are, Ernie and Kiki Vandewey for the Knicks. Gerald Henderson Sr. and Jr. for the Sixers. Doc and Austin Rivers did it for the Clippers. And John and Rick Barry both did that for the Rockets. So very, very good company there for Larry Sr. and Larry Jr., the Nance boys in Cleveland. All right, hey, Kush. Real quick, just simply because we've got a lot of basketball on the brain here, what do you say we shift gears and talk about the ice for just a moment?
I'm cool with that.
Do you have or did you already scalp those walleye tickets that we have for Friday's game against Quad City?
No, I didn't have enough time to scalp them yet. Come back and ask me that question tomorrow.
What do you say if you still have them? We give a pair of them away. And I love it that it's more Friday night hockey because it is still Lent, and the Lenten season means you've got to spend Friday with fish, do you not? So the walleye and Quad City Mallards, a fish and a bird. Let's get at it. Going together on the ice, 7:15 face-off on Friday. We got a pair of tickets for you. Caller number four. They're yours at 866-240-1065. And we're back after this.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
An extravaganza is exactly what it is. Thanks for being with us. Boy, oh boy, I apologize. I spend the entire break there while Jim Cushman's doing the bottom of the hour local sports center, and I clear my throat and I do my hauls and I get all of that stuff out of the way, and then we come back on, and yeah, there it is anyway. Sorry for that. Anyway, Cush, the montage that you played at the top of the hour had a lot of voices.
Yes.
And by the way, congratulations. I'm sorry, real quick. Congratulations to Earl Nielsen of Sylvania. He was paying attention, and he got in as the fourth caller to win those walleye tickets. We have more tickets we'll be giving away throughout the week.
Right, assuming here. I haven't scalped them.
assuming Cushlin isn't out there making a little extra cash on the side, on the parking lot, working his magic, we can definitely expect more tickets to be given away. But be that as it may, you had a lot of comments there in the montage from Mike Golick, from Carlos Boozer, from Jay Billis, and from Brian Windhorst, among others, talking about this new NBA initiative, since we're talking a little NBA this hour now, the new NBA initiative to find a way to, quote, engage elite high school athletes, finding a way to give them something other than just a quick ticket to the NBA by way of ending the one-and-done rule. Some way to get them involved in the system, some way to get them taken care of, to get them paid a little bit so that they don't just sit and starve until they can come to the NBA, but without making them have to go through the college game. And that is, of course, a big challenge. It's something that a lot of people have been trying to figure out for a long time. What about these young kids? And I understand some people make the analogy to, you know, a prodigy like Justin Bieber or, you know, a prodigy like, I don't know, a classical musician joining an orchestra at 18, and they can go out there and make just tons of money. They don't have to wait until, you know, they go through some college that they really don't want to attend in order to start making money. And they're saying the same thing with players. And obviously the difference is when you are a musician, a la a Justin Bieber, somebody who's a teenager who's a prodigy, you are an independent contractor, and you are free to go out there and sell your wares. You don't have to work in the context of a league with an employer. Your employer is the consumer. If you can make good music and a label signs you and you put that music out there and it's bought a billion times on YouTube, iTunes, then you go out there and make all your money. That's great. But that's different than when you're trying to work for a company that is a part of a larger organization made up of, you know, ownership groups that are working in concert with the players' association, players' unions. It's a very, very different animal. And because it's a different animal, you can't just say, hey, I'm 18, I've graduated high school, let me in right now. Now, if the NBA were to agree to that, if they were to waive the one-and-done rule, Jim, how long? Do you know approximately how long the one-and-done rule has been in effect?
I want to say about 2005, 2006, because it was a couple years after LeBron came in.
Yeah, LeBron.
Let me triple check the exact date, but I want to say 2005 or 6.
LeBron was either the last or one of the last one or two guys to come straight in out of the NBA, or excuse me, into the NBA out of high school. And he, of course, came in 2003.
Yeah, it was 2005.
And it was at that time, and this is one of those misnomers, and I talk about this all the time. This is one of those misunderstandings, if you will, in which people think that it's the NCAA trying to keep its pockets lined with the labors of the young star players who are saying, you can't leave, you've got to come here for at least one, you can't go pro. That is not the case. It's not the truth. And it's something that I think has been perpetuated intentionally by some who want the NCAA to be the evil entity here, to be the bad guys. And, you know, call them exploitative, to accuse them of not paying their labor, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm talking about people like Jay Billis, who to me has gotten on far too high of a horse for my liking on this issue. They want the NCAA to be the evil entity. Even Stan Van Sloppy, back when he made his incredibly uneducated remarks about a week ago, a week and a half ago, in which he said that he thinks the one-and-done rule is racist, and it's only in place in the NBA or in basketball because the majority of basketball players coming out are black, and it's not in place in baseball or hockey because those are white, and it's kind of interesting how he just curiously left out the NCAA football program, which requires you to stay 3 years. You can't go into the NFL until 3 years after your high school graduation.
Now, Stan Van Gundy or Jay Billis, by the way, Bob aside, that's a very good point before, right before that, to, you know, to bring up to remind people, because it's always easy to, you know, to make the NCAA the bad guy. You know, they're we all pretty much can tell their incompetence on certain issues that make us pull our hair out. So that's easy to do, but you're right. It's not correct. This is technically an NBA rule, which has been one of the reasons that college basketball is getting ruined.
Exactly,
which has always
right.
been my opinion on the subject this whole time.
I don't disagree. There needs to be a fix here, but for three sides, there's three sides of this coin, if that's possible. There's the NBA side, there is the NCAA side and the college programs, and then there is the player side. All three of those need to be addressed in this situation because everybody is impacted to a large degree. But the part about this being an NBA rule is really, really important to note because it takes the racial component out of it. The NBA is an 80-85% black game in terms of number of African-American players. It's an 80-85%, and they're making millions and millions and millions and millions, and many of them hundreds of millions of dollars. So to claim that the NBA is somehow in any way racist whatsoever because of the one-and-done rule is just about one of the dumbest things anybody could ever say. That's Stan Van Sloppy. But going to the issue now of the NBA's decision not to let the players come, why do they do that? Why was the one and done rule instituted in the first place? And the reason why is because the number of players who are physically and emotionally slash mentally mature enough to make the leap from 18-year-old high school phenom to the NBA, it's infinitesimal. It's tiny. There are far more players who just don't like school and who just don't like going to the idea of going to college and being a student athlete. That will declare for the NBA draft even though they're not ready, and the teams know they're not ready. So the problem is, well, the solution for the NBA was, well, then we're going to make sure that they just can't make that unwise decision to jump when they're not ready, because we are stuck in a situation where if we try to forecast their long-term ceiling and take them number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 or anywhere else in the lottery early on, and they don't pan out, it sets us back. You know, generally the lottery teams are obviously, unless trades have been made, the lottery teams are terrible teams. And they can't afford to miss on those picks. They can't. And it's impossible to scout them based on what they've done just in high school, again, with the rare exceptions of the LeBrons and the Kobes of the world. So they've said if we take them, we run the risk of missing on it, you know, a la Kwame Brown or something, and hurting ourselves for a long, long time to come. If we don't take them, and somebody else does, and they're a star, we hurt ourselves for a long time to come. And the kid, if he's not ready, ends up blowing his career because he's going to suffer greatly at the hands of NBA players who are going to show him no mercy. He's either going to sit the bench or he's going to be forced into games that he's not ready for, not physically or emotionally ready for. And it's going to hurt him long term, you know, in terms of his career earning potential. So the NBA says, here's our solution. You can't come out of high school. You've got to at least play 1 year in college. But as you've pointed out, Jim, that has severely hurt the NCAA because now coaches are torn. Do we recruit the four-star athlete that we think will be here for 3 or 4 years and build a championship, you know, run through? Or do we recruit the five-star guy who we know is going to go to the NBA as soon as he plays 1 year for us? And the temptation, of course, is too great to turn down the five-star player to see if we can make a run at it in 1 year. But everybody suffers as a result. And also, because of the temptation, if you will, to go get these five-star guys is so great, like the kid in Arizona who is, you know, alleged, according to a reported FBI tapes, Sean Miller, the coach at Arizona, was talking about a $100,000 payment to this kid. He's supposedly the best player, might be the number one pick, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, because they know they've got to get this guy one time and make a run at it, or else somebody else is going to get him, and, you know, you end up being an also-ran in the NCAA tournament. So you have three entities suffering. The NBA game is, well, they're not suffering quite as much. The NBA game is pretty much, hey, you know, we have an idea of, after seeing them at least 1 year in college, what some of these guys are. But the college game suffers, the college coaches suffer, and yeah, the kids who might not want to be a part of college basketball because they don't want to be a, quote, student athlete, they just want to be an athlete, are forced into a situation making a mockery of the educational system that they have no interest in actually participating in, and they have no other options. So now the NBA is offering this, you know, or not offering, but how did Brian Windhorst explain it? Trying to engage these young players and to give them another opportunity, maybe without forcing them to go to Lithuania the way the Ball brothers are, Jim. And maybe there is a semi-solution there. But in my opinion, it's one that's going to have to be coupled with a solution to one and done.
Yep.
And that solution would be two and done. Meaning, we will lift the one-and-done restriction. If you are good enough to come to the NBA, somebody will decide it and draft you.
Yep.
Running all of the risks that I mentioned before for both player and franchise to screw it up. But if you decide to go to college, you have to make at least a two-year commitment. They make three in football. We're just saying at least a two-year commitment where you actually have to go to school, remain eligible, and learn from the best coaches at the Division I level, and then really enhance your draft stock that will then help both the NBA team that drafts you because they'll be a little more assured of what you can do, even though there's no sure thing. And, of course, it will be better for the player who will be much more mature physically and emotionally and mentally at 20 than they are at 18.
Yeah, and when I look at this, too, I found a little a link that takes me to all the various high schoolers that were, you know, drafted straight out of high school.
Yeah.
And clearly, you know, your LeBrons and, to a degree, Amari Stoudemire and Dwight Howard. Going back to Kobe and Kevin Garnett in the mid-90s, you know, that's still hard to do. But honestly, I'm looking at this list, and, yeah, you're going to have your flops like Durrell right here, but I'm also seeing guys like Monta Ellis, C.J. Miles, J.R. Smith, currently of the Cavs, Al Jefferson, Kendrick Perkins was another. So in other words, they're not all, you know, flop-type guys right out of high school. So they're not all going to be LeBron James-type stars either.
Certainly not. But the key here, Jim, isn't the ones that you mentioned that made it into the NBA.
Yep.
And made, you know, in some cases, decent careers out of themselves or for themselves. And in some cases, LeBron, Kobe, you know, Hall of Fame careers for themselves. It's the number of guys who would declare for the draft and not even get drafted.
Yes.
Because, and thus, because they declared for the draft, they can't go into college ball, and now their careers are over. The agent has sold them a bill of goods. Maybe their high school coaches have sold them a bill of goods. Their parents have said, go for the money now, and they want to go and get drafted. And no, they've severely overrated their own stock. And those are the individuals you're not going to find on any list. The number of them who might have been able to play at a college program, but they blew it because they decided to go to the NBA or try to go to the NBA draft.
No, so very true. So very true. I mean, yeah, this is just a list of guys who were actually drafted. If you were to lift that, and I think, you know, I'm looking at it again, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So five guys in 2003.
Which was the last year that it happened, right?
Because in 2004, and then I'm seeing 9 in 2005. And then the rule got, you know, instituted by the NBA.
Oh, so it was instituted after the 2005.
Yeah, draft. So what I'm also kind of seeing is I think the NBA was panicking a little at the same time on a subject that nobody brings up anymore. At the time, early 2000s, especially 03 through 05, there was, relatively speaking, a ton of guys from high school that got declared and drafted, and I think the NBA didn't like that. It's one thing to have the occasional LeBron or way back in the day your Daryl Dawkins type of player, but they didn't want 10 in the same draft.
No, they don't. The NBA is not supposed to be a developmental league.
Right.
That's the thing. If you get that many young kids coming out, and again, most of them are not going to be ready, and it becomes a developmental league. They want their players coming in to be polished and ready to go right out of college, I should say. And if they come out of high school, they're just not going to be. So there have been some other suggestions here, by the way, that I want to throw out there. Steve Kerr, the coach of the Warriors, another guy that I don't have a ton of love for, but I certainly appreciate when he's talking about basketball and not other things, said this yesterday. Don't keep this ruse, the ruse meaning that some of these kids are students. They're not. We all know what's going on. Let's do what's best for the kid and give them some options and work together between the NBA and NCAA to find the right system. I think it's doable if people just open their eyes. Under the current system, underclassmen who leave college and sign with an agent are not welcome back to the NCAA. Kerr said, there's part of the answer. Quote, one of the things the NCAA needs to look at is, if a kid signs with an agent and doesn't get drafted, why not welcome him back? What's the harm? We talk about amateurism and all this stuff, but if you're truly trying to do what's right for the kid, and the kid declares for the draft and doesn't get drafted, you know what? Welcome him back. Do something good for the kids. College players who declare for the draft but do not sign with an agent can maintain their eligibility if they withdraw from the draft process by a specified date. Now, I want to just address that real quick because I know we got to get to the top of the hour Sports Center. But the problem with the suggestion that Kerr and other people I can make in that regard is, if you allow them to sign with an agent, you allow them to take money because the agents are automatically going to start giving them money, all right? Money that they expect to get back on the back end when they sign their professional contracts. And if the agents are allowed to give them money, you open up the cesspool, if you will, to certain college boosters funneling money to the agents and saying, get it to that guy and make sure that our guy comes back to us. Make sure that if he doesn't get drafted, our guy comes back to us. And if you allow them to take agents, if they're already in college, you're going to allow them to take agents when they get right out of high school. And now money goes to an agent who's going to steer the individual to a certain school to start with. The problem for me is that, and I know what Kerr is saying is get rid of the word amateurism altogether, but it absolutely has to be there. You have to make sure that the amateur status of the athlete is maintained. Otherwise, it is just the highest bidder. The North Carolinas, Dukes, Ohio States, and other programs of the world that have the most money are going to outbid through the agent process for all of these players to bring them in. And then what? Then you're going to have, hey, you may have solved the problem of too many young kids going to the NBA because they won't have to, because they're going to make a bunch of money playing at the college level by way of money funneled through the agents. I think if you want to keep the semi-level playing field that you already have in Division I college basketball, Kush, you have to make sure that amateurism is maintained. If you open it up to payments from agents, then you essentially are saying you're a professional. And if you're a professional, it's all about negotiating the best price, negotiating the best contract. How much are you going to give me to sign with you? And I don't care where it comes from, and you tell me where to go, and I'll go there. And now it is just, it's going to be, it's going to be like the NBA. You're going to have a couple of super teams or maybe a small handful of super teams, and a whole bunch of teams that can't afford to buy players.
I do at least appreciate that these little incidents and these discussions, and then, of course, the big scandal that's, still going on and still being investigated, all that stuff very recently in college basketball especially. But, a lot of these same discussions on some level apply to college football too. Regardless of where you stand on it, I'm kind of glad that we're at least having the discussion of the amateurism concept in college sports, given the corruption that's already been going on through the years. I'm glad we're at least having that discussion because things have gotten so far in this direction. That being said, I would like it to still be on the amateur kind of thing.
Yeah.
But as LeBron pointed out last week, When we were talking about all this stuff, I'm same as you. When he says something especially worthy of notation, especially related to basketball, it's worth, I think, paying attention to. And this is the one where he was talking about, which others have echoed, revamp, do something with the G League, revamp it, to make it a true minor league. That has to be a step, especially if you're going to keep the amateurism that I know a lot of people, myself on some level still to a degree as well, would like to still see on the college side of thing. But to me, the biggest thing is that middle ground of an actual minor league kind of system, because the G League still isn't it. As I point out to you last week, Bob, they would need to add a minimum of two teams, minimum, so everybody can at least have an affiliation, because that's not the case right now.
And then the difficulty with that, of course, Jim, is let's say you have, you know, 30 minor league teams forming a true, you know, minor league system, if you will, where each team has their own farm team.
Right.
Are there 300 near-ready NBA players to stock 30 10-man rosters? You know?
I see your point.
Or 360 if you go with a 12-man roster? I don't know.
I bet given the choice, since they'd be, regardless of what it would be, they'd be getting paid either way. I bet a lot of those kids would love to stay in the U.S. and not go to Europe or China or something.
Yeah, I would agree. But like I said, only the ones that are really, really like the five-star elite kind of prospects, because the ones that are on the lower end, they're not going to pay them a bunch of money, because these leagues will not be profitable. There's no G League, you know, minor league system that you're talking about that will be profitable. They're all going to have to be floated by the parent club. They're all going to have to be kept afloat that way to pay the players, pay the coaches, pay for the facilities, and so on and so forth.
Same way it works in minor league baseball. They don't make a ton, and the parent club at the end helps out with that, has been for decades in their
system. Yeah, they do. But as I've said to you before, many of them are profitable. Many of them are profitable, because the minor league baseball system, it does draw fans in various cities. But I don't know how many fans are going to be coming out, and I also don't know how much the parent club is going to be willing to pay.
Agreed.
The 12th man on a G League bench,
right? No,
let alone on the major, or on the, you know, the NBA level bench, and that's something that has to be considered as well. Okay, there's so many different angles on this. We'll talk more. By the way, Memphis coach Tubby Smith has a strong stance on part of this as well. I'll tell you what he had to say as we continue the discussion. And we welcome you, by the way, 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. We'll try to get you up on the radio after the top of the hour, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Good to see him attack. Missed it. And flushed by Larry Nance Jr.
Nance measures.
And he hits a 16-footer.
Nance open again.
Hit it again.
Nance a bump.
And a bucket and a foul. Nance with a steal.
Boy, oh boy,
he's omnipresent.
He is something else.
Inside Larry and a finish for J.R. Smith. How many Larry Nance Jr.'s are there out there?
Putting Larry Nance Jr.
Who drills it? He's hit three jumpers tonight.
So Larry with a career high with 20 points.
We made them feel our presence. You know, we hit first and had an aggressive mentality from the start. I was establishing myself on the inside first. Once they did that, they had to respect the outside. They had to sag off something. Those guys gave me great looks at the top, and I got to knock those down as well.
We did it by committee. It started with me and Larry, obviously. You know, we knew he was going to have to try to do a job on those two big guys that they have with Blake and Drace. And high energy plays is what he's all about. Very fast, athletic, puts himself in a position to be successful on the floor. He's always in the right spots.
We're just right now really not giving ourselves much of a chance to play well, because we're playing so frustrated right now. Frustrated with the referees, frustrated even more by the ball not going in the basket. We're a very frustrated group right now. It's very hard to play like that. What we're getting right now is we're getting one or two guys play well on any given night. We're just not getting enough people to play well, particularly offensively shooting the ball. We can never find more than one or two guys that are making shots.
The G League wants to up the ante and say, okay, there are guys that will go straight to the NBA. You other guys, if you can't make it to the NBA, don't want to go to college, come here. You're going to get paid more than the $26,000. We're going to prepare you for the professional life of an NBA. We're just going to do it better for you. So if you don't want to go to college, you don't have to go to college.
For some of these kids to just go play overseas, or like the Ball Brothers are doing right now, instead of going to college. Me personally, I was excited about going to Duke and having a chance to win a championship and winning a championship and enjoying that whole college atmosphere. I was there for 3 years. I really enjoyed my college personally. For me, it was perfect for me, but like I said, it's situational for each individual kid.
There's a difference between being elite and elitist. And the NCAA right now, we have become elitist. We are telling a bunch of young, largely African-American kids, we don't want you at all if you don't want to buy into our 4 years thing.
Basically, one and done is going to go away, but it's not going to go back to the way that it was back in the early 2000s when a kid could just declare he was going pro and he got drafted by the NBA. The NBA has basically decided that they want to get involved with high school players, and I don't think that they have wanted to do this, and I think they recognize that there's going to be challenges that they can't foresee and there may be stumbles, but they want to be able to get involved and have their hands on high school players and then give them an alternative option when they get out of high school.
I don't give a damn how great he is. You don't take a running back with the number one overall pick in the draft as far as I'm concerned. If I got the number one overall pick, I need somebody that's generational. I need somebody that I think is going to last 10 years. If it ain't a quarterback, it's a Lawrence Taylor type. That's how I'm looking at it. I'm not taking him with the number one overall pick unless I have a quarterback. And last time I checked, the Browns do not.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. We roll onward. Hour number two at 16 minutes after 4 o'clock. We are going to talk a little bit of college basketball a half an hour from now or so. Todd Kowalczyk, the coach, the man, the driving force. There you go. Instead of voice, I'll say force. They sound kind of the same. It covers up my mistake. The force behind the UT Rockets as they head into MAC tournament play. BG's season ended last night in the first round. The Rockets have a double bye, obviously, to the quarterfinal round, and they will play on Thursday, Jim Cushlin, against the Miami Redhawks. Am I correct?
That is correct. That's a Thursday evening game, but Coach will probably be a little busy earlier in the day. We've usually been talking indeed to him Thursdays every year, so thanks to the UT people for rearranging and able to get Coach today instead.
Yeah, very much looking forward to talking to the coach about the season-ending loss, regular season-ending loss to Eastern Michigan, their second in three games. Rough way to go against Eastern.
Who, by the way, if seeds fall in terms of things go chalk in that quarterfinals on Thursday, Rockets would again get Eastern then in the semis, by the by.
Oh, my goodness gracious. You know what? You know what I'm seeing happen here, Jim? What does that relate to? What does that equate to? Think of the Big Ten. Penn State and Ohio State.
Okay, I see where you're going with that. Okay.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you're like, uh-oh, somebody, at least for a year, you know, in one season, has somebody else's number, even if the other team is the superior team, even if the other team is the team that has the better overall record, the better conference record, the higher seed. All of the above Ohio State had but couldn't beat Penn State this year is just one of those weird little anomalies. And it sounds like that might be the situation. Well, let's hope that's not the situation. If they do, if it does come down to it, let's hope that the Rockets face Eastern. But you understand my point.
Yes,
it's just
now
one of those
weird
little things. You know, so I, you know, hopefully that isn't the case. But we'll talk about all those possibilities and prospects. I'm sure Coach Kowalczyk doesn't want to talk at all about Eastern other than the last game. Wants to focus on Miami and the challenge of the Redhawks on Thursday in the quarterfinal round. Hopefully they'll be playing all the way through the weekend at the Q out in Cleveland so that they can have an opportunity at Ye Big Dance. Okay, want to get back into a couple of things. I want to play this. This is one of the clips on the issue of the NCAA and the NBA and the problem with one-and-done rule. A lot of people have a lot of constructive things to say. A lot of people just have a lot of asinine things to say. Jay Billis is one of the latter.
There's a difference between being elite and elitist. And the NCAA right now, we have become elitist.
Why? What's elitist about trying to run a for-profit program? You know, these schools invest so much money in these programs, into the scholarships for these kids, and they expect the kids to go to school, take advantage of what they're being paid, which is, you know, $150,000 to $200,000 for an education and all of the ancillary benefits that go with it. They expect them to go to class, get that education, and take advantage of what is being offered them while also participating in their sport to the highest level of their ability. What is so elitist about that? Is it a for-profit venture? Of course it is. Absolutely. There's big business. But everybody has a role in a for-profit big business. The coach has a role. The administration has a role. The university has a role. The players have a role. Everybody has a role. And as such, everybody has benefits. Now, the colleges make a hell of a lot of money. Millions and millions and millions of dollars at the big-time college program. Maybe not at some, not at every program. Not at, who was it who just qualified for the tournament? Radford? With that buzzer beater, Jim, over
yes.
Liberty?
Yes.
Yeah. They don't have a multi-million dollar take every year in terms of revenue. But the larger programs do. And guess what? That's their benefit from running these programs. The kids have a massive take as well. It's just a question of whether or not they want to take advantage of that benefit, that salary, that payment. If they choose not to, how is it elitist to tell these kids we want you to go to school and we want you to play here and we want you to get your education? Because again, I don't know how many times they need to be told this, the vast majority of you are not going to the NBA. You're not going to play basketball for a living. So what are you going to do with your for a living? What are you going to do with your life? If you're smart, you will use that basketball ability you had to get here and use that to pay for your education so you don't have to take out loans, et cetera, et cetera. And then you will go on into your professional life in a very, very great place. How is that so elitist, Jay Billis? I get very aggravated when I hear people like Billis spewing this kind of trash.
There's a difference between being elite and elitist. And the NCAA right now, we have become elitist. We are telling a bunch of young, largely African-American kids, we don't want you at all if you don't want to buy into our 4 years thing.
What does that mean? What is Jay Billis talking about? Kush, I don't know if there's more context to that. I feel like there has to be. First of all, what does race have to do with anything here? How does race come into play here? Are the rules different for whites and blacks? Are NCAA member schools, Division I schools, do they have different rules for white players than they do for black players that come into the colleges? Because if they aren't, if the rules are the same, why are you bringing race into this? The only person who is elitist here, Jay Billis, is you. You are trying to stoke racial fires where they don't exist, and you are trying to turn the NCAA into some sort of a villain here. When the NCAA is simply running a for-profit business, which is what major college sports are, absolutely, while paying young athletes, the vast majority, 90-plus percent of them, who are not good enough to go to the NBA, paying them for their services to help your school make all of that money. And the way you're paying them is by giving them an opportunity to go out into the workforce after they don't make the NBA and do something great with their lives. How is this in some way advantaging people who happen to be African-American?
We are telling a bunch of young, largely African-American kids, we don't want you at all.
Who says we don't want these guys at all? They want them, in fact, to stay as long as they can and to get their degrees. Again, the one-and-done program, Jay, you disingenuous hack, is not the fault of the NCAA. It's an NBA rule.
You don't want to buy into our 4 years thing.
Buy into the 4 years thing. Jim, if there's any more context to that cut, and you can lengthen it for me on the front or the back end or both, please let me know, because I would like to understand a little bit more about what Jay Billis is trying to do. I have never heard anybody quite as disingenuous as a Duke-educated Jay Billis, who continues to trash the member schools and the organization of the NCAA itself, who made him famous. That's right. His Duke education, bought and paid for, by the way, by his basketball talents, sent him to where he is now, where he's had a broadcast career of 20-plus years of great success. And he is vilifying and demonizing that very organization. In fact, people like Billis should understand him more than anybody, because he wasn't great enough to be an NBA player. I don't think he did. Was he ever drafted? And if he played, I don't know if he actually played in the NBA. I don't think he did. He's 54 years old, so he's a little bit older than I am, and I don't think he ever played in the National Basketball Association, if he was even ever drafted. Let me just have a look, quick check. See. Oh, here it was. Yep, back when they did have a longer draft. In 1986, he was drafted in round 5, 108th overall by the Mavericks. He never made it in the NBA. He played in Europe 1986 to 1989. So here's a guy who benefited from the education that Duke offered him. He stayed for all 4 years. Got his degree and is on his way, to a wonderfully successful broadcast career. And that's exactly the way it's supposed to work, because the vast majority of college players are Jay Billis. They're not, pick your favorite college player this year or any other given year. It's not the guy who's going to be the number one pick in the draft. It's not going to be the vast majority of these guys are not lottery players. The vast majority of these guys are never going to make it in the NBA players. You have a career to advance toward. Take advantage of the education and do it. So I get very frustrated with people like Jay Billis who make those kinds of comments. Now, to a different part of the same story, if I may. Tubby Smith, the head coach at Memphis, of course, formerly head coach at Kentucky and other places. He's one of one of the better known names. Tubby Smith has a message for players who are looking to transfer out of schools as soon as they realize that maybe they're not quite good enough to start, that maybe they're not quite good enough to be the focal point of the offense, even if they are a starter, and they want to transfer schools and go play somewhere else. That's one of the things that critics like Jay Billis and others, and I'm a little bit more open to the discussion on this with these individuals than I am the others. Critics say if the coaches can transfer, meaning leave one job while in mid-contract and go take another job, why can't the players do the same thing? And I have to admit, like I said, I'm more open to that conversation. What's good for the coaches ought to be good enough for the players to a degree, to an extent. The problem, of course, is the mass chaos. There's 317, isn't that right, Jim? What's the number of?
Actually, I saw the RPI sheet yesterday. It's actually 351.
Oh my, even more.
Yep.
So there's 351 coaches at the Division I level. Having them moving around from program to program is already tough enough. But each one of them has at least, 12 to 15 scholarship athletes?
Yeah.
351 times 12 to 15, you don't have to do the math, it's okay. It's a few thousand guys. And every time somebody doesn't start, every time somebody isn't getting their role in the offense they thought they were going to get when they were recruited, they want to put in for a transfer to go to a new team, and then that team has to find a way to rip some scholarship, because remember, they're not always guaranteed, rip a scholarship from a 10th guy on a bench to make room for the new guy who wants to transfer in from another school because he's not doing as well there. Thousands of – it would be mass chaos. It would. It would open up again, in my opinion, more – of that, that Pandora's box, if you will, when it comes to opportunities to pay players. Boosters are not just going to be looking to pay their own players. They're going to be telling players at other schools, talking about the dirty ones. Obviously, there's that FBI investigation going on right now about a number of dirty programs. But, you know, boosters at school A are going to now be talking to players who are freshmen at school B and saying, you should have come here. You should have come here. If you'd have come here, you'd be playing by now. Tell you what, put in for your transfer. Tell them you want out, and there'll be something waiting for you on the back end. Now, I'm making that very blatant, obviously, the way I phrase that, just for the sake of discussion. Usually it wouldn't be that blatant, but that's the kind of thing that could happen. Tubby Smith says allowing transfers for athletes makes them quitters. It teaches them to quit. This ESPN article from this morning. Memphis coach Tubby Smith expressed his displeasure Sunday with the high number of players transferring in college basketball, telling reporters the practice teaches athletes to quit. Memphis was hit particularly hard by transfers after last season, when 6 players transferred from Smith's team. On Sunday, he was asked whether he thought the bulk of his team would return in 2017-2018. That prompted a rant from Smith on the new NCAA regulations that allow players to transfer whenever they want. It's not exactly that. Like I said, it would create chaos if it was whenever they want. There are circumstances now under which players can transfer, which is new, by the way, a new development. And you can see why, again, the chaos that it's creating for a program like Smith's. I want to let him speak for himself as I read his quotes, but just to, again, kind of throw it out there, the obvious... one of the many obvious sticking points in this. Let's say you are a Tubby Smith, and let's say you have, 7 guys under scholarship returning, and they play, 2 of them are point guards, 3 are shooting guards, and 4 of them are, I know I'm off my number there, or 3 of them are front court players, whatever, and you recruit based on what those needs are. Then you find out a bunch of them are transferring, and suddenly you've got to fill those spots, but all the recruiting period is over. And, all of the best players are already signed someplace else. You didn't recruit them because you thought you had this guy locked up. It creates mass chaos. And the fact that they are able to transfer now much more easily than they used to be, although it's not free in every case, is a step toward that chaos. Anyway, the rant from Tubby Smith, quote, "I've been in this business a long time, never seen anything like it. We had over 800 Division I players transfer last year. We're teaching them how to quit. That's what we're doing. Things not going well? Let's quit." Smith has been the head coach at 6 different NCAA schools since 1991. But he said players who transfer need someone to tell them you made a commitment, stick to it. He acknowledged that most players have a lot of people in their ear. That's kind of what I'm talking about, why they can't just allow this to be, you know, a free-for-all. Smith told reporters Sunday that he wanted to transfer from High Point during his freshman season in 1969, but in his case, his father was there to tell him to stick to it. He said his father asked him if somebody did something to him, and when he said no, his father replied with several questions. You're still getting your scholarship, aren't you? They're still feeding you, aren't they? They're still housing you, aren't they? You still getting an education? When Smith replied, yes, sir, his father said, well, then you can't come home. Your bed's been taken, but you can join the Army. Smith said Sunday that this was the best thing he has ever said to me. Cush, do you agree that allowing players to transfer, number one, it creates mass chaos for the programs, as I described, but number two, it does teach, you know, young men at the developmental stages of their adult lives, they're young, going from high school to college, 18, 19, 20 years old, this is such an important developmental phase, teaching them that if I don't like the way it's going, I'm quitting. And that doesn't do them any good at all, especially when the NCAA and the member institutions of the NCAA, the schools, are responsible for developing these people and making them ready for the world. Not just to play at the next level, as we said, a very small percentage of them do, but making them ready for life at the next level. Okay. And teaching them to quit is not a good message.
I'll say this, that's an interesting take from Tubby Smith, one that I hadn't really heard or thought much about before. As for the transfer rules, therefore, in general, and I've kind of had this opinion starting with, I know when this subject would come up in on the football side of things too, I'm fine with the transfer rules the way they are, except for one thing. They need to be more lax if the coach leaves. That whole aspect, which happens in basketball a little bit too.
Hold on, let's clarify that.
Okay.
It was my understanding that's exactly how and when they are allowed to transfer is when the coaches leave. They're not allowed to transfer willy-nilly just because they get a bug up their butt right now, are
right.
they? Doesn't it have to be a situation which the program has changed leaders and then the kids get to leave?
In my understanding is either it is or they're trying to work to that without the sitting out part, because the back half of any transfers, you're then supposed to basically sit out a year after you go to the next school. I'm fine with that, honestly, in almost all situations, except the one where your coach leaves, then you shouldn't have, as the player, if you wish to transfer, you shouldn't have that back end restriction. Only if the coach leaves. Otherwise, you should still be stuck in the same transfer rules, which currently in theory are, you transfer out of a school, you gotta sit out for that next year before taking the field or court for that next school.
Okay, that was my understanding as well.
Right.
And when you're talking about, you know, some of these athletes who are only gonna play 1 year in college anyway before they try to go to the NBA, that's irrelevant. They're going to transfer and then they're going to have to sit the next year. They weren't going to play the next year anyway. I'm trying to find the best wording for this or the explanation of this, because it was my understanding that the only way somebody can transfer and play right away is if the coach leaves right now. If the coach leaves, you can transfer with no penalty. Tubby Smith said 800 players did that last year. Is he saying that 800 left under coach leaving circumstances, or is he saying that they all transferred and are all willing to sit out a season? That's what I can't figure out.
Right. That's what I'm trying to figure out, because I know in recent years that's been one of the things that, as we know, in a football context especially, but also in the basketball context, this aspect of it has come up, and I get the impression, therefore, it didn't. If they've changed it, it didn't start out that way, is what I'm trying to say. Even if the coach left.
Is the rule different for football than it is basketball at the NCAA level?
You know what? That's a good question.
Let me share this, okay, real quick, and then I'll let you finish your point. Our friend, the commissioner, Bill Conley, from College Football SB Nation, wrote this back in January, so this is 2 months old. It's been clear since the moment the 2017 college football season ended that one of the primary topics of the offseason would be changes to the existing NCAA transfer rules. In mid-January, a potential every student athlete can transfer once without having to sit out a year at his or her new institution proposal began to float around in the ether.
on Tuesday, and again, this is January, so going back January, CBS's Dennis Dodd reported that an amended version of that proposal was taking shape. In a proposal presented by Baylor professor Jeremy Counselor and Iowa State professor Tim Day, athletes would be able to transfer without sitting out as long as they met one of a few guidelines. And it talks about earning a baccalaureate degree at the original institution. The head coach was resigning or fired or left. Sanctions had been imposed upon the original institution, so if you get your school got in trouble, you can leave without you being penalized, et cetera, et cetera. But that was about football, and I'm asking if basketball is different than that, because this is obviously, when Tubby Smith says 800 kids transferred, I find it hard to believe that 800 kids agreed to sit out a year of their college, you know, their college careers.
Right, right. And kind of what I'm looking at right now, I'm on the NCAA's website, but I'm reading through this and I'm questioning how updated this is. It does say under exceptions, as you mentioned, the one-time transfer exception. But it also says right under that part of the one-time transfer exception, if you meet all of the following conditions, and it reads thusly, you are transferring to a Division II or III school, or you are transferring to a Division I school in any sport other than baseball, men's or women's basketball, or football in the subdivision.
So that hasn't changed. It's been that way for decades.
Right, right. So if this is an updated site from the NCAA that I'm in right now, Student Athletes Current Transfer Terms is the site that I'm on through the NCAA.org, then no. Right now, then, it's saying you can't for basketball, men's, and that was what we're talking about, and football. So, no, and apparently, if I'm reading this right, the rules still are, even if your coach leaves and bails on the program and you, you still have to sit out the year if you transfer, which is why I think that's come up in recent years. In the context, when a coach leaves, should a player be allowed to leave? I know that question has bubbled up to the surface every now and again these last couple of years. And I think this is why. If this site and this rule is still accurate, and I'm not reading from an out-of-date NCAA.org
No,
site.
I know what you're reading from, and I think you're right. It is. And what's interesting about it, Jim, is there's also a link on that page about if you want to transfer, here's what you need to know. And that's something I think let's work on for tomorrow's program. We'll see if we can get a guest on to kind of explain this in elementary fashion. I always love the movie Philadelphia and Denzel Washington. I'll get somebody to explain it to us like we're four-year-olds. Because, no, I mean, really, sometimes the most elementary explanation is required for things like this. Because I think it's a very fair point. It's a very good question about how we keep NCAA athletes happy and not wanting to jump to the NBA too soon, and those kinds of things. I think the one and done, the transfer rules, the NBA getting involved with elite athletes at a young age, all of these things are tied together, and I think we should discuss them as such. All right, it's 4:38. Let's get a quick timeout here. We'll check our bottom of the hour local sports center. Then we'll come back and talk college basketball in a different way, the kind that's played on the court. That's right, UT. Rockets coach Todd Kowalczyk will join us to talk about their quarterfinal matchup on Thursday against Miami in the MAC tournament out at the Q in Cleveland. It's coming up next.
Now, back to Bob France, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Interesting choice of songs here by Jim Cushman. It's not a long way home for coach Todd Kowalczyk and his Rockets. It's a long way to Cleveland. It's even a longer way to a championship that will be achieved in Cleveland. It's going to take three rough battles, no question about it, the first of which comes in the quarterfinals on Thursday as the second-seeded Rockets will face the seventh-seeded Miami Redhawks in those MAC quarters. And joining us now to talk about this is head coach Todd Kowalczyk. Coach, how are you?
Doing great. Hey, Jim, great choice of music.
You're welcome,
Come on, Bob.
Coach,
Bob, you got to appreciate that, Aaron.
Oh, I do. Oh, believe me, that song and many others from Supertramp are on my iPhone. Trust me, it's on the playlist.
Good.
Yeah, I do like it. But I just figured I'd play with it a little bit because it's a long journey. This has been a long journey all season long, Coach. Journey to Cleveland. You obviously are in a very, very good position with a double bye, and you get to get the second seed in the tournament and an opportunity to, you know, to earn your way into the NCAA tournament. And this is what it's all about. This is what you fought for all season long. How do you feel? Did the season fly for you, or was this a long grind for you, Coach Kowalczyk?
I think it's always a long grind as far as just the physical and the mental, but it's amazing. When you love your team and it's a joy to coach them every day, how it does go by faster. You know, and I've really appreciate, you know, the guys we have here.
You know, and you should, and that's a great answer because it's true. You know, while you're in the middle of it, it is a grind, and there's a lot of long practices and a lot of long film sessions and corrections to be made and highs and lows, you know, joy and misery from certain things. But then when you look back on it, you're like, oh, my God, I feel like we just started our training camp for this season, and here we are getting ready for the MAC tournament. Coach, let's talk before we look ahead to the Miami matchup on Thursday at the way the regular season ended on senior night. It wasn't what you wanted to send out your seniors, obviously, with another loss to Eastern. First of all, just give me your impressions of how that one came down, then we'll talk about the ramifications.
Disappointed with how we played offensively to start the game. You know, we had some really bad and careless, you know, just their zone is really good, and I thought we played too much east and west and not enough north and south against it, and that leads to turnovers, and turnovers with them lead to transition, you know, and that's what they lived off of. And overall, you know, I think an unbelievable game. Both teams played very hard. I thought, you know, take out our start offensively, very pleased in how we played for the most part. Came down to really four plays at the end of the game. You know, it, you know, we had, you know, Morion Jackson had a bad turnover, and Trayshawn Fletcher had a bad turnover, and two calls that, you know, I would highly disagree with that went against us during winning time. And, you know, that happens, you know, and unfortunately, I think if those four plays, if just one of them goes our way, you win the game.
Yeah.
You know, we still had open three to win the game.
You still had a shot at it, and that's a great point as well. Despite some of the adversity, despite some of the questionable calls, you still had a shot at it. That's exactly right. Coach, what do you – and again, obviously I would never ask you to look past your first game, but I'm just pointing out the fact that it's one of those weird little things. Two very good games between two very good teams, yourself and Eastern. Obviously, you came up on the short end both times in two of the last four games of the regular season. If you end up in a situation where you get them again, does that bother you, or do you feel like – the old adage, it's hard to beat the same team three times in one season, that it's something where you've learned enough where that kind of thing won't bother you?
I don't think it'll bother us one bit. You know, I think our guys over time have proven they're a very good zone offensive team. We're a very good zone offensive program. I consider their zone as good as it gets. And I credit their program for helping us become a really good zone offensive program, because we've had to learn and adjust and adapt over the last 7 years. Our guys are confident against it. They know what we did wrong. Those are correctable mistakes. But there is some value in what you said as far as matchups. I'll be honest with you guys, the one team that I really didn't want to play again was Western Michigan. Just because I think they may be the most talented team in our league. You know, and they, I guess fortunately for us, unfortunately for them, they got beat last night, but they were if you remember guys, they were the preseason pick to win the West and the overall championship. They have a very, very talented team. When you have a really talented team, all you got to do is just put it together for 3 games in 3 days. And obviously they've had some ups and downs, but that was the one team going into it. It's like, man, I'm not sure I want to see them again. And luckily we don't have to.
That's a great point, Coach. We're talking to UT Coach Todd Kowalczyk, whose Rockets are getting set to take on Miami, the 7 seed in the MAC tournament, coming up on Thursday in the quarterfinal round. Coach, you haven't played Miami in the tournament since 2012. The Rockets haven't since 2012. That's a long time ago. Tell us about this matchup and what you know about the Redhawks.
A little trivia about that game. The last game of Charlie Coles' career.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, in Savage Arena. And obviously very, very fond memories of him and at Toledo, the head coach of Central Catholic, and people in this town adored him, as I did, and the whole conference did. But yeah, that was his last game.
Did not realize that.
I mean, he retired in our press room right after the game.
Wow. Well, it's obviously a different team now, and let's talk about the matchup. Again, you know, you're talking about a 500 season for Miami. Sometimes that can be misleading. What is it that you I don't want to say fear, what is it that concerned you the most about Miami and your preparations and watching them?
A very talented team. I think, you know, Jack Owens, is a new coach this year, has done a remarkable job. You know, they have a junior college point guard, Ringo, who at one time was second in the country in assists, second in steals. He's really impacted the game. They inherited, you know, some decent post players that are playing well for them. And then they got three freshmen that they brought in, you know, that are very, very talented. Nyxus Beatty is probably the best of three. Delonte Brown, if people in Toledo know, he had a very good freshman year for him. And Jalen Attaway. I mean, they're a very talented team. Not the most experienced, but very talented. Very, very athletic. Can really pressure the ball. And defensively, they're going to get out and try to deny us and really pressure us.
Coach, you know, I asked you about, you know, Eastern, if you were to face them again in the semifinal round, if you're fortunate enough to get by this one, and your two losses to them. So let's talk about the win over Miami. How much do you take from that going into this, and does that have an impact at all on yours or their psyches going into the quarterfinal?
Not at all. Our players respect Miami's talent level. I know that, you know, we beat them at their place, and that was a while ago. It was Wally Szczerbiak night. I'm sure they're, you know, if there's any impact on the psyche, they want revenge, and I understand that. But been playing this game a long time with stuff like that. I'm not sure that all that, you know, coaching psyche when it comes to all this stuff is you know, really works. And that's about us.
Well, what about the X's and O's, Coach? What about from that standpoint? Is there things you can take away from that win that make you feel good about this from that standpoint?
Well, I think both they probably feel good about some things and not so good. And the same thing with us. We didn't make shots in that game. If you look at it, we shot 28% from three. That's not us. What we did was make plays, but we also, Willie Jackson didn't dress because that was when he was hurt. And Trayshawn Fletcher was a game time decision because he was sick. Didn't think he was going to play driving down there, to be honest, the day before. He didn't practice the 2 days prior to and didn't think he was going to play. But he kind of gutted it out and didn't play, you know, great, but certainly helped us, you know, get a nice road win. But I do think we made big plays at both ends without making shots, which I think is when you can do that on the road, it's a sign of a good team. And that's what we did that night.
Coach Todd Kowalczyk of the Rockets joining us on this Tuesday because his normal time on Thursday is going to be a little busy getting ready to play Miami. Jim Christian, go ahead.
And, you know, thinking about the tournament coming up with this Mid-American Conference tournament, the one thing that I always find fascinating is how you, from the coaching standpoint, would handle the one aspect that you don't see a lot during the season. Maybe if you play one of those early season kind of mini tournament things, you might get this, but usually there's at least usually a day. But should you advance past this game, you get to then you'll play again Friday night in the semis. Should you get past that one, you'll be playing for the automatic NCAA bid on Saturday. In other words, back to back to back with no days off. From the standpoint of a coach, and especially in a sport like this where you're used to having, you know, multiple days off between games, usually it's about 2 a week or sometimes maybe only one day. How, from a coaching standpoint, should you guys advance, do you handle the kids to get the right kind of shoot-arounds and sessions in when you only have hours between a game and not days?
Started at 8 p.m. on Friday. We put a 6 p.m. national TV game on Friday against Eastern Michigan and started at 8 p.m. All of our plans were set in place. We knew that, you know, so Saturday for us was going to be I wanted to do some things because we lifted at 1 p.m. We did it at 1 p.m. so the players wanted to go watch our women's team play. Then they went to La Scola's, great Italian place here in Toledo on Saturday night. We didn't practice, but just gave them some time to sleep and get off their feet. Sunday was a clean our house day. Worry about things that we need to get better at, you know, and motion offense being number one and zone defense number two. And then we scrimmaged a lot. So we went up and down and went for a long 2 hours. Monday was, you know, a recovery day. We lifted. And we brought in three really good masseuses. They got massages. Tuesday today was about Miami. And then tomorrow, to be honest, you guys, we're not going to do much at all, but just kind of walk through and saving legs and being fresh is important for three games in 3 days. So it's about managing is what it is.
No, and there's no question about that. I'm also thinking, too, what would your itinerary for you and the guys be, say, the end of Thursday and you guys win, so you're advancing to Friday. Between the end of Thursday and Friday, how does that get handled from your standpoint? Because there's not a lot of time for shoot-arounds or even the film sessions.
It's all scripted already. We know by the minute. You know, and unfortunately, because there's a lot of, you know, there's games going on with the women's tournament there too. We can't get into Quicken Loans. So you're talking about if we win on Thursday, our day on Friday, we have a 9 a.m. shootaround. We're not going. We don't need it. We're going to have a 10:30 wake up call. We're going to let them sleep in. We're going to have a 10:45 film session, 11 a.m. team breakfast. Go right from team breakfast to walk through in a ballroom. We'll have tape on the floor like a court. And then we'll have a stretching session, and then we'll walk through this mall for a half hour, just get their legs loose, come back. You know, and it's a 9 p.m. game, so our pregame meal's at 5. We'll also have another film session around. So we'll have three different film sessions in a matter of, you know, 20 hours.
Coach, I'll tell you what, I hate that the music is playing right now because I love this conversation. I would love to find out how you scripted it to the minute, but like you did, has it changed over the course of the years that you've been in this?
Yes.
Known how to, you know, and developed it and tweaked it and fine-tuned it and things that you've done before that didn't work. But that'll be a conversation for next week, hopefully, as we get you prepared for the NCAA tournament, because you're going to have a great weekend in Cleveland. Coach, thanks so much for the time. Always, we'll look forward to catching up with you next week. Good luck on Thursday and the rest of the weekend.